It is Radio City on PopDose.com. John Grayson here with you alongside Rob Ross from The Dose. And Rob, boy, this room looks different all of a sudden.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's where do we begin? It's great. It seems a lot bigger and broader and wider and shinier and suddenly looser.
That's right. Even the furniture is more comfortable. Yeah, it works for me, man. So we've got a lot to go over, plenty to talk about this week, and we should start with a little bit of history because there is a how we got here. We had been doing this bit on the radio for, a few years now, and then all of a sudden the radio show changed.
Yeah, I mean, it was going on 4 years come August.
Yeah.
And, it became a very regular thing on Monday nights where you'd call me and we would just have a conversation about anything and everything that pertains to pop culture, whether it's music, art, books, politics, movies, things that are on Pop Dose and just milling around in the general pop culture universe.
Exactly, yeah. And it was so much fun that we decided to just keep it going and it had no better home than right here at PopDose.com. So very excited about this, and we certainly, again, have a lot to go over this week. And I want to jump in with some new music because you were the one who introduced me to Cindy Dawson and the Sins years ago. And they've been friends of yours for a very long time, and they've got new music out again. Tell us what Cindy's been up to.
Well, The Sins have a brand new single out now because it's the taster to their upcoming full-length album, which is terrific. To know that they're going to release something is wonderful.
Yeah.
And they've grown, as and as so many people know, in leaps and bounds over the last 2 years of releasing singles one by one. The last single, Devil in the Details, still lives with me because it's just such an incredible song, musically, stylistically, delivery-wise, emotion-wise. It's just a very positive shopping list of all good things, and it points the direction towards where they're going now. And this new single called Let It Burn is a real eye-opener because it's just pure out-and-out, heavy-duty, deadly riff rock, but with drive and motor and feel and balls.
Yeah.
And I can say that now.
That's right. And that's the thing that's been the most fun to watch is the evolution of the songwriting, the evolution of the execution, because the sound was always there, but now it starts to feel like they're getting comfortable with it.
I completely agree. I think it's the fact that there's such chemistry between the four members of the band and the workings between Cindy Dawson and Henry Size as the songwriters, that's just, it's unmistakable. They've got such fluidity and skill in writing and knowing. And Cindy, I think, is one of those lyricists who can just hand over the sheet to Henry and say, here, you know what to do, and he can do it.
Right.
A very rare thing, I've seen it happen in a couple of bands. I've experienced it, I'm happy to say, in my own at one point. And the thing is that Cindy's own comfort as a performer has also, I don't want to say matured, but it's ripened.
Yeah,
because you can tell, especially in the last couple of tracks, from Right to Your Grave onward, that she herself is feeling a lot more confident in front of a microphone and in a studio setting, I should say, because on stage she's an absolute firepower.
Yeah.
But in a studio setting, where it can be sometimes a little bit daunting, I think she's finally found her feet and just can really let loose and let it feel.
Excellent. So Let It Burn is there for you elsewhere on Pop Dose. And Rob Ross and John Grayson here hanging out, doing some talking about the latest. And that kind of confidence is the perfect segue into the next artist we're going to talk about, Linkin Barr. Linkin Barr's got some history, and it takes that kind of confidence to be able to jump from one style of music to something completely new. Let's talk about the history first. What is Linkin Barr's band? Where did he come from?
Well, you and I know him, and the readers of Pop Dos know him from a band called Red Jacket Mine, who are Washington State-based. And we've dug them for what? Almost the entire time that you and I have been doing conversations together. Because they've got that wonderful big star Todd Rundgren, Elvis Costello, Smithereens kind of power pop vibe, sound, and execution. But Lincoln Barr has stepped out on his own and done a complete 360 from anything that you would remotely equate with that band. You know, and for someone who is as young as he is, this record, which is called Trembling Frames, it's the sound of someone who's been through it all, been through the ringer, and is so experienced in life, you would swear it was somebody in his mid to late 40s really putting it all out there. The best way to describe this as almost like a cafe jazz styled approach towards the execution, the playing, the arrangements, and yet the lyricism on this belies anything you would probably expect in a cafe jazz style. What I mean by that is most jazz records of that era that I've ever listened to always have a sort of wistfulness, a sort of love song feel, romance, very cinematic paintings. You can imagine yourself walking down a rain-covered Parisian street,
right,
or something akin to that. But here the lyricism is very dark, and it's extremely personal. And
yeah.
There's a, you know, an almost, I've just experienced this, and now I'm trying to purge this. Cathartic record.
Right, and there's something, I think it's easier to talk about what it's not sometimes than what it is, because you hear guys do this from time to time who move from the pop world and they buy a jazz record and go, hey, I can incorporate some of that into what I'm doing. It's not jazz-infused pop. It's a completely different thing. There was an album a long time ago, one of my favorites ever, from Stan Ridgway called The Big Heat. And Stan Ridgway, of course, from Wall of Voodoo. And he does a song on that album called Walking Home Alone that is unlike anything else he ever did. And it's that's what I thought of a lot while I was listening to Lincoln Barr do his thing, because it's completely other.
You know, it's funny. You bring up Stan Ridgway, who's one of the stalwarts of the 80s. My immediate impression, and I'm almost apologetic in saying this, is that it reminded me of an album that I loved that came out in early 1984, and I mean genuinely loved and was highly influenced by. It was the debut album from the Style Council, Paul Weller's debut after the Jam,
yep,
called Café Bleu, which on a musical level, I would definitely say they're not too dissimilar, but on a lyrical level, it's a completely different thing. And the problem I always had with the Style Council was the pretentiousness and preciousness of it. And it was always very hit or miss with them. But it's that same kind of feel that I got from Trembling Frames. The difference being that Lincoln Barr's lyrics are far more coherent.
Knowing, yeah, definitely. So you got to get a copy of Lincoln Barr's brand new album. It's called Trembling Frames, and it's out and available now. And we move from there into some video. There's a video premiere on Pop Dos this week for a song called She Burn from Wade Jackson. Let's get some history on this. Who's Wade Jackson?
Well, Wade Jackson, as you know from a couple of months ago, is this incredible, as far as I'm concerned, power pop master from Australia. He's a multi-instrumentalist, and he did an album called Whiskey Alpha Delta Echo, which knocked both of us out, and right. I think a lot of the pop dose readers. Definitely in that vein of the Byrds and REM, Beatlesque, some Beach Boys, certainly some Big Star, some Van Doren influences. But now he's working on a brand new album, which is called Crown and Cathedral. And he's unleashed his first single and video from that album. It's called Sheburn. And the interesting thing is that this is unlike anything I would have expected out of him. So again, we're seeing something completely different and diverse from an artist who we already have been introduced to through a different sound and style. Because Sheburn, video-wise, is just absolutely stunning to look at. It's colorful, it's bright, it's near psychedelic in a lot of ways, and very moving. But the thing is, the track is very electronica, dance, trance, you know, pulsing,
right,
rhythmic, with very little vocals in it. Enough to keep you interested in the track, which makes it worthwhile to listen to and absorb, because more often than not, something that's got that kind of trance, rave style usually gets tedious very quickly. This doesn't. So by doing what he did in melding the vocals in there in a very subtle and subdued manner, you know, it works, and it makes the track work, and that's why I think it has so much enormous value. It also shows a very different side to Wade Jackson as a writer and performer.
Yeah, and you got to love that sort of posterized 60s psychedelia that's evident in the video shooting of this as well. So definitely one to check out, and we'll link to this. It's, again, Wade Jackson's She Burn. The video is on Popdos. And we, you know, everything gets covered here. And one of the things that you and I find ourselves ranting about on a fairly regular basis is the latest in politics. And, you know, when the press conference happened, when Donald Trump took the stage behind that podium and did whatever it was he did for over an hour, it was so hard to fathom what was going on and what was going through his head. And it's clear that his administration is taking on that same personality of having no cohesiveness to it at all. It's all based on Donald Trump's whim at this very second. And that's kind of a scary thing.
It's scary. It's irresponsible. It's ponderous for those of us who are bearing witness to it.
Yeah.
It's disturbing. It should be angering to the, I would say, entire population. I, at this point, don't know what to make of it, because I don't think I have felt remotely right in my mind, even in my soul to a degree, and I don't mean that to sound dramatic.
No, it's clear. There's something terrible going on here.
Something terrible and something so out of control and out of anybody's grasp, because we've never seen this before. The problem is, we can't continue, especially the House of Congress cannot continue to allow this to keep spiraling so out of control, because we're talking about an absolutely cataclysmic horizon.
Right. Well, how do you have a president of the United States who's working out policy in his head in front of the press during a press conference? It's like he's going through these things and thinking, well, I haven't really thought about that yet, so let me just talk this through in front of the press. That seems like a really bad idea.
And then, simultaneously to that, his ongoing confrontational approach to the press,
right,
makes things even harder and worse.
Yep.
Harder, because there's no sense of a conversation or dialogue. It's all finger pointing, accusations, belittling, evasiveness, and certainly no answering the questions asked. The most direct of questions he will not answer,
that's the
cannot
thing.
Answer, does not answer.
Right, and it's
and
his crutch.
To me is travesty.
Right, it's his crutch. It's what he leans on. As soon as he gets into a place he doesn't feel comfortable, he starts yakking back at the press and calling them fake news and all of this garbage. But, you know, there was one piece of it that really stuck with me, and I couldn't figure out for a couple of days what it was that was wrong, because when he made that quip about, well, you know, the greatest thing I could do is shoot that Russian spy ship out of the water, the thing about it was so flippant and it was so completely irresponsible, and that's what people seized on. But there's something else that's incredibly sinister that's lurking in the background of that, which is this. Where's the response from the Russians?
It's a very good question. I don't even know if I've seen or heard anybody discuss that angle of it, because certainly what you said about him being flip and irresponsible, there's no question about it. I mean, that's just plain dangerously reckless.
Right.
That's so cavalier and so... Forgive me, because I don't even think I have the right words
to
fit this one.
Yeah, it's not even the standard bullshit. That's the problem, is that we're used to that by now, and it's more than that. But, I mean, when Reagan made that joke about, you know, I've just signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever and we start bombing in 5 minutes, he was laughing as he said it, and the Soviets still issued a statement condemning this attack by the Americans. And here's a president who says, I'm going to shoot that ship out of the water, or says the greatest thing I could do is to do that. And they don't say a word. Why?
There's another problem with that. And also, his credibility is absolutely nil right now.
Right.
I mean, you make that, it's already gotten to the point where the minute Trump says something, most reasonable and rational people, politicians alike, kind of turn their heads and go, oh, Jesus.
Right. They just shake their heads and walk away.
Stupid thing. Right. Another stupid thing comes out of his mouth. But at the same time, not just when it comes out of his mouth, because in so many ways, people don't even look at him as a president. They just look at him as a clown. And I mean that in the truest sense of just being, you know, the game show host that he's been all along, a big mouth in an empty suit.
Right.
But it's his cabinet that makes this reek even more of sinister and so off-putting. Case in point, Stephen Miller. Now, there's a guy who
wow.
I think we can definitely take him apart in just a few broad strokes easily.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody would disagree with us. I mean, you saw the way he presented himself on the air. You saw and heard what he said about not questioning the president without blinking. You know, it was a very... it was a very Goebbels-like kind of approach.
Sure.
And, of course, the thing that I find so frightening about someone like Stephen Miller, and here you go, you know, one of his close friends in college apparently was that fellow from the white supremacy party who had gotten punched in Washington the day of the inauguration.
Right.
What's his name?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, and I can't think of it either.
Yeah, and the thing is, they were close friends, and Stephen Miller happens to come from a Jewish family. He is Jewish. So that tells me a lot. And
Richard Spencer.
Thank you, Richard Spencer. He and Spencer apparently were friends in college. Now, what do you say to something like that? How do you make heads or tails out of something like that? I mean, you know, is it a fair presumption to say that you could liken Miller, even though I don't really want to go down this path because it's been so overdone and overwrought, saying, well, it likens him to the Jews who were in the concentration camps who helped the Nazis, like the Capos.
Right.
You know, I don't want to take that approach, but, you know, what is that?
Stephen Miller needs to take his self-loathing and deal with it on his own terms and leave the rest of us out of it, I think is what it comes down to. But yeah, I mean, it's a mess, and the entire thing is a complete mess, and it's not getting any better because nobody seems to have control. Nobody seems to have a hand on the rudder of this thing, except perhaps for Steve Bannon. And boy, isn't that a frightening little thought.
Frightening and also appalling and angering. And if you're not angered by the fact that Steve Bannon has so much of a part in all of this, then you really have blinders on and you're dumb as a rock.
No doubt.
Because it's all there for you to see. It's been played out. You know, and I have to say, this, to me, just watching from the periphery as I do and as you do and as we all are doing, this is a constitutional crisis. Something has to be done by the powers that be to seize this and say, enough.
Yeah,
we cannot go any further. We have a country that needs to be fixed. one way or the other, whether it goes towards, you know, a bipartisanship or even towards the right, at this point, it doesn't matter. But somebody has to take control of this.
And the only somebodies who can.
And stomp out the fire.
Right. And the only somebodies who can right now are the Republican-controlled Congress. Great. So there's that. And, you know, that's what we're facing here. And somebody, I mean, it's going to have to be Paul Ryan or someone in the Senate who steps up and says, enough of this stuff. We're going to have to do something about this. And I'm not going to hold my breath. But the more this craziness goes on, who knows what can happen. So all the more reason to keep it here and, you know, keep listening in every week to what's going on and pay attention. I mean, just watch what you see in front of you and interpret it and pay attention to it for what it actually means.
That's the most vital thing of all. People need to remain informed, and they need to be, I'm loath to use the word now because it's becoming too frequently thrown out there, but we need to be vigilant.
No doubt. No doubt about it. So a bunch more to talk about. John Grayson here with you. Rob Ross here with us as well, doing some talking about just whatever happens to wander by us. And some of the things that we've been focusing on just lately are the sad goodbyes and fond farewells. And certainly, again, we're just eat up with them this week. And a couple more stalwarts from the wrestling world. George the Animal Steel died. And here's a guy who I think probably better than anybody got it. He understood the showmanship, the gimmick. He was like the William Castle of the wrestling world, you know? And he was just, again, he was a guy you could not rip your eyes away from.
Oh, he was wonderful. He was so entertaining, both as a heel and, God, when he turned babyface, he was so much more loved and embraced. Now, From my days as a child and even as a teen watching wrestling, George the Animal Steel was one of those wrestlers. Once he appeared, you always looked forward to seeing him again because he had his shtick down pat. You know, the thing with the turnbuckle and the green
right.
tongue and couldn't speak. I mean, it was hysterical. You know, and you know, suddenly when he became, like I said, a babyface, oh my God, did we all ate it up, even though I was always a big fan of the heel, because they always made the storyline so much more interesting. But
sure.
He was apparently such an incredibly nice, kind, gentle, generous, caring man that if you asked anyone, I don't think there was anyone out there who just didn't absolutely love him.
No doubt.
He was just one word. Beloved by all.
Right. And you know, just a day after George the Animal Steel died, we lost Ivan the Russian Bear Koloff. And again, another guy who was so great to watch because not only did we get to take out our anxiety and our sort of animosity on the bad guy, but he was a Russian on top of it. So, I mean, at the height of the Cold War, what better time to have a guy like the Russian Bear out there?
I know. In fact, if my memory serves me correctly, and I do say serves me correctly, he was the first, quote, Russian bad guy wrestler that I encountered because
yep.
I seem to remember him before, long before Nikolai Volkov came along. But the great thing, of course, about Ivan Koloff was the fact that he was really a Canadian named Oriel Paris.
Right.
He's from Ottawa.
Right.
You know, but his first wrestling gigs were under the name of Red McNulty. You know, that was, I mean, that's just absolutely classic. You know, that was the beauty of wrestling back then. You know, a guy could come in, not really succeed, go out, come back as somebody else and be a complete superstar. There's so many of them that you and I could go over. We should actually talk about that one of these days. Just, you know, some of our favorite remake and remodels, you know?
Yes, definitely.
But,
and, you know,
he was just such a character because my earliest memory, and I'm going to say around 75 when I was really coherent and really getting into wrestling. And again, because I'm from New York, the only thing that we had at the time was the WWWF.
Right.
You know, this was not AWA, NWA territory. That was sacred. You know, that's why we read the wrestling magazines. But we always had just the WWWF, and it was his ongoing feud. And that was the other thing. You always had patented feuds. Him versus Ivan Putski. the Polish power.
Right, right. Oh, too much. And you know, again, gone at age 74, and it's more evidence of the fact that, you know, the wrestling world is now going through a very similar thing to what the rock and roll world went through over the last year plus, which is the fact that, I mean, these are now all guys who are in their 70s and have lived a life that wasn't exactly easy on the body.
No, and I this may come out wrong, but I guess I am more relieved, if you will, that with their passing, it's just a case of age,
yep,
time, the injuries, and so on and so forth, because neither George Steele nor Ivan Koloff were young men. This wasn't a case of the seemingly dropping like flies of heart attacks induced by steroid use that so many of them went through, like Kurt Hennig and the Von Erichs and Brian Pillman.
Right, right, and expect that in Major League Baseball too, by the way, because now a lot of the guys from the steroid era are hitting their 50s and some of them into their early 60s now. So it's another thing to unfortunately be on the lookout for. But yeah, it's some sad goodbyes there, and again, fond farewells to some of our favorite wrestlers. And there's one more thing I want to talk over this week, because as we all continue to advance in age, one of your colleagues at Popdos also made note of the fact that there are guys, especially in the music world, who continue to be not only viable, but continue to invent fantastic music into their 60s, into their 70s, and some of them even into their 80s. And it's the old guys rule column. Talk a little bit about this one.
Well, Rob Smith did an outstanding job with it because, first of all, he targeted on two particular older artists that have released new material in the last year or so, Ian Hunter and the venerable Willie Nelson,
yeah.
And, you know, I love Willie Nelson, so that's, you know, that's always a joy to see or hear him do something. But, you know, I think it's in the broad sense of what Rob is trying to get across is the fact that it doesn't matter how old you get, if you can still do something meaningful and listenable and palatable, people are still going to be coming back to you.
Right.
You know, I'll give you a perfect contradiction to that. Paul McCartney is my hero. He's been my hero almost my entire life.
Sure.
Certainly musically speaking, but I think even in the bigger picture. But I would say that I have found little to no interest in the things that he has recorded and released since 1982, since Tug of War. I think that was the last time that, A, I consciously went out of my way to buy a new album by Paul and listen to it.
Yeah.
I've liked a few tracks here and there in the time since, and that's what now? 35 years?
Right. I go a little farther. I go Pipes of Peace, but still, yeah, same era, and he kind of lost
the one that
me
came
after
right afterwards. Right. So you graced him one more album, so that's very good of you. I have to admit, I took great umbrage with such a piece of... Oh, I can say it on the air now. With such a piece of shit like Ebony and Ivory, which is just such a nothing song.
Schmaltzy,
I'm sorry.
I
know it's supposed to have meaning and depth and so on behind it, but that was just garbage, you know? And then, of course, he releases something like, which I didn't care for, Pipes of Peace with Say, 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 and I just thought, oh, God, what are you doing? And so subsequently, I've never really cared. You know, My Brave Face is a great song.
Yep.
This one is a magnificent song. That possibly is one of the last great things the man has done.
Right.
But since then, I just could not care less. I don't care how many albums he's released, and certainly when you go see him live, his voice is finally going, and you can tell it's going because he just can't really belt it out the way he used to. Even when he speaks, there's sort of a hoarseness and a rawness that just isn't there like it used to be.
Yeah.
So when you go and you look at somebody like Willie Nelson, who's also a very different kind of performer, you know, or Ian Hunter, you know, Ian Hunter doesn't release albums every year or every 2 years. He releases them as he feels necessary. And certainly, you know, he's had such a long and storied career since the beginning of Mott the Hoople. But he took his time, he released something new, and people are loving it. And when he goes out, even though he's in his 70s, he still goes out and gives you 150% in his performance.
Right.
The same thing can be said about Willie Nelson. Now, Willie Nelson doesn't go out and put on a, quote, show, but he gets up there, he gets up in front of that microphone, he sings his heart out. He pretty much, to me, still sounds no different than when I first heard him back in the 70s.
Right, and he still plays that guitar, and as fallen apart as that thing is, and as many straps and clamps and things as hold that thing together, it still sounds absolutely gorgeous, and it's almost a metaphor for Willie himself.
Yeah, I mean, and so the notion that the old guys still being able to do it and still having the validity, I think, is 100% on the mark.
Right.
You know, there are going to be people who will be and have in the last couple of years put out new records that still have the same kind of vibrancy and vitality to it. People like Tom Petty or... let me think. Who else?
Yeah, right. It kind of drops off after that. But I know what you're talking about. And
it does, simply because so many people do release records that it's almost kind of hard to keep track with them.
No, but you can tell who's still having fun, and that's true, I think, too. Is the difference.
Hey, here's a great example. Cheap Trick put out what is it called? Crash Bang Zoom Hello. What was it? A year or two ago.
Right.
And even though it wasn't my favorite releases by them, it still has that kind of Cheap Trick-like youthful energy and vibe. I'm sure it's because Dax Nielsen brings a lot of the youthfulness and energy in now, playing on his first album with the band. But the point being is that they still have it. You go see them perform live, they still have it. You know, you can go to see a lot of these older performers. Stevie Nicks still has it.
Yeah.
Chrissy Hynde still has it.
I think there's an underlying message in here that we're missing. Smoke a lot of dope, kids.
Well, you know, I really didn't want to venture down that path, but I because, you know, that's just never been my bag. But
no, but still.
Okay, you know, listen, whatever floats them. I mean, hey, you know, shit. You got me with that one.
Every single one of the ones you mentioned, they're famous for it, especially Willie. So, you know, I just figured there had to be something there.
You are quite correct.
Welcome to the normal hour. Yeah, right. So, you know, again, it's a fantastic column. It's Rob Smith's Vinyl Diaries. It's called The Old Guy's Rule. So you definitely want to check that one out. And just, hey, that's the great thing about it is that you can, in the comments section, leave your own artists who you think are still viable after all these years, because there's more than a few of them putting records out.
Yeah, and they're going to keep going until, God forbid, they drop.
Right.
I certainly see it that way. And what I love is the fact that, getting a little bit away from Rob's column, is the fact that they don't give a damn one way or another if they have record deals or not. You know, that's almost irrelevant now. You know, a lot of them are just, you know, doing their own thing, putting out the records and going straight to the fans by virtue of their websites, which I always felt, even though it cost me my career with record labels, you know, you eliminate the middleman. You know, here's the perfect scenario. Here's something that we can talk about for a moment, because we do have the time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the artist. I've recorded an album. I don't have a record deal, but I have a website. You like what you heard by me. You buy the album directly from me.
Yep.
Therefore, it cuts out and negates the middleman, the record company. You know, whatever you've paid for my album, you're paying for the cost of recording, me putting together the materials needed to physically release something or download it, any whatever, you know, means I put it out by, but it's going direct from fan to artist. And I think if more artists do that, it will finally put an end to what they call the quote-unquote recording industry, because for so many years now, no one at these labels have listened. You know, don't forget, when I left working for formal record labels in 2003, there were still several major labels in existence. There are only three now.
Right. Yeah.
So what does that tell you?
Right. I think it says something about the effectiveness of the labels, too, because there was a time when you had to depend on them for the marketing, for the promotion, for the oomph behind the release. And even that, they just don't have that anymore with the death of rock radio. I mean, there's nothing, there's no avenue anymore that has to go directly to the people other than through the web.
Well, definitely the death of rock radio is a major component, but also there's no avenue to really push or promote music like it used
right.
to be. You know, I started seeing this happening around 1997, 1998, whenever it was that the Backstreet Boys and then Britney Spears and all of these people started to come up and take the headlines. You know, it was all marketing and tie-ins to other physical products, like my new album goes along with my new jeans line or the lipstick or perfume line that I'm trying to push.
Yep.
It was an afterthought. It's not about the music, you know, and then shows like American Idol came along and made things even worse. You know, I will say this much, and I'm not going to lie. There were some songs that were born from the American Idol experience. Like Kelly Clarkson put out two magnificent singles. You know, now whether or not she would have gotten where she got without American Idol remains to be seen. But I mean, you can't negate her talent as a singer and having two fantastic songs. But I mean, the rest were such charlatans, and God damn it, they just really ruined whatever it was, whatever kind of machinery that may have worked no longer worked.
Well, you nailed it.
And the other thing. The other thing is also, and I got to say, from the insider's point of view, having people at a record label not get behind your album is completely crushing. You know, during my years at Atlantic Records, I was witness to watching one band who put out an absolutely stellar record, and they had sold a ton of product for Atlantic. And when it came time for their third album to be released, this album I thought was just so many miles ahead of their previous two. No one at that label could even be remotely bothered. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a look and that shake of the head going, eh, whatever.
Right. Well, when pushing a product becomes first and foremost, and then the artistry becomes secondary, that never works out well. And I'm going to make a really strange comparison, but when you and I were kids, we grew up watching cartoons from Warner Brothers and Disney and all of these other houses, Hanna-Barbera, that were all competing with each other to make a better product than the other guy was making. And at some point during our childhood, making cartoons became a vehicle to selling toys. As soon as that happened, the artistry fell off and the cartoons became crap.
You're absolutely right, because first of all, if you look through any TV channel, you're not going to find any of the cartoons we grew up with.
Right.
You might find a couple of the Hanna-Barbera things on Boomerang or Cartoon
Network. At 2 a.m.
Right, because it's owned by, all of it is now owned by Turner. But
right.
The thing is, you know, the stuff we grew up with, whether it was Warner Brothers, Hanna-Barbera, Terry Toons, all of that is gone. You know, it's all toys. It's all Pokemon or G.I. Joe.
Right.
Or, you know, when we were kids, there were no G.I. Joe cartoons around.
No.
We had a toy, we played with it, and then we didn't.
Right.
Because you grow up and you move on as a child.
And
you know, it's a very rapid process.
Right, and our cartoons were being made by Jay Ward. I rest my case.
Also, our cartoons were made for kids. You know, there's a lot of very sophisticated and deeper humor. I mean, certainly the Warner Brothers cartoons were masters of subversiveness.
All right, so was Jay.
Because,
yep.
You know, come on, let's face it. You know, the whole use of the transvestite image, whether it was the Wabbit or the Fudd, you know, or the duck dressed as Carmen Miranda, you
right.
know, we grew up with it, and we for some strange reason, our generation definitely got it. But that's because we grew up in with I think parents and grandparents who told us about those days and those people. Our grandparents and parents watched these cartoons with us and would say, you know who he's imitating? And then they would tell us the background.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and there was so much more to it. And that's the whole point, is that they were just competing to make a better thing. And that's always going to be the times when you're most creative. And right now, with everything going on in the world that's there to comment upon, to write about, to create over, there's really nobody out there to do it. Except for the old guys.
No, exactly. And then for the old guys, quote unquote, to still keep going, I salute them, because, look, we're not young men either. And time is passing very rapidly, and who knows what's going to happen around the corner.
Exactly.
So, you know, the more the guys that are out there that certainly we grew up with and loved are still doing it, I'll certainly be there championing them. You know, I wish that so many were still here, because I would hope that they would see how well loved and received they are. I mean, God knows, every time I watch Big Star Nothing Can Hurt Me, my heart breaks and I still get tears in my eyes, because I wish to God that Alex Chilton and Chris Bell and Andy Hummel were here to see how well loved and how received and how rapturous their music is to people. And if the four original members of Big Star could go out on a stage, I think people would go absolutely bananas.
Yeah.
You know, I am sure if Lennon were still here, I mean, that's of course the big one, or if Keith Moon and John Entwistle or Keith Relf of the Yardbirds, who never saw the accolades that the Yardbirds wound up getting, or, you know, just so many of them. It really does. It's heart-wrenching in a lot of ways. So that's why if there's somebody out there like a Steve Winwood or a Tom Petty or an Eric Clapton or Nick Lowe or even Elvis Costello and Paul Weller, you know, just all still going out there and doing it. I mean, my God, Paul Weller is I think 59 this year, you know, and he's been a part of my life since for the last 40 years.
Right. Right. And so they're still good. And in fact, that gives us the opportunity to promote what's coming up next week, because among other things, I just sent you this a little while ago. Steve Hackett has a new album out. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. What else we got coming up next time we talk?
God, there was a ton of things from last week. We're going to talk about Travis Linville, who put out a wonderful new record, a band called Scotch Hollow from Kansas City, who just put out the coolest little stomp I can think of. I mean, really just fantastic. Matthew Walcott, who put out his debut EP, and it's one of the finest debuts I've heard in many, many years. All I have to say is, just to give you a real inkling of what it is, I'll listen to his voice, and the first thought is, he sounds a lot like a slightly younger Peter Hall sample.
Nice.
Vocally. And most importantly, a brand new album from the Feelies.
Excellent. So we're looking forward to that. We'll do it all next week. And Rob, for our first edition of Radio City on popdose.com, I think it went pretty well.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, there were no flubs. There was nothing to really edit, and we don't have to worry about being bleeped out for saying bad words.
There you go. So on behalf of Rob and myself, I hope we pass the audition. We'll do some more talking next week on Radio City. Be here for it.
Thanks a lot, John. I'll talk to you soon.